مالي خمن لگر مالي خالومو لگر مالي ننكمو هرسي كان كودو لتوا
Aras Abid Akram walks, as he does every week, to the grave of his loved ones in a local cemetery. But this is no ordinary grave, and this is certainly no ordinary cemetery. I'm John Simpson, the BBC's foreign affairs editor, and for this BBC World Service programme, the Halabja Project, I've come to Iraqi Kurdistan to recall horrific events that took place right here some 25 years ago, the most destructive chemical weapons attack ever perpetrated on civilians. It was in this cemetery that many of the thousands of victims are buried, including 24 members of Aras's family, loved ones whom he himself had to bury.
His mother,
his father, seven of his sisters, four of his brothers, his aunt, all her children, two little children of his sister, her grandfather, her grandmother, everything that he had, all his relatives.
And you put the bodies in with your own hands?
He buried them with his own hand.
I don't think that many people could imagine the horror of burying the whole family like that.
He's saying if you were in my place, you would have done the same. I believe it's God, it's my destiny that I am still alive so I could tell this story again and again to people.
The story is remarkable and horrifying. A lethal cocktail of chemicals dropped without warning, claiming thousands of lives and giving the wider world its first glimpse of the kind of extreme brutality that Saddam Hussein was capable of perpetrating against his own people. It was believed to be Baghdad's retribution against those Kurds who had welcomed a recent advance of troops from Iran at the tail end of the Iran-Iraq war. I've now returned to meet some of the survivors and to hear about new efforts to resolve some of the enduring mysteries that still surround the attack, the results of which I saw for myself some 3 days after it happened. We went in low to Halabja in an Iranian Air Force helicopter, hugging the hillside in order to keep away from Iraqi planes and artillery fire. Geographically, Halabja is in Iraq, but its people were Kurdish and owed little allegiance to the Iraqis. For that, they paid a heavy penalty. This amateur video filmed... This was how I reported the story the first time I came here, 3 days after the attack. I'd been flown in by the Iranian military, which was keen to demonstrate the barbarity of Saddam's tactics. I found a town strewn with debris and with bodies, left as they'd fallen.
And here we have Tragedy Hall, the famous man, Omar Khawr, who becomes a symbol of the martyrs.
The town today has a museum to commemorate those terrible events. The bulk of the display is really just photographs, row after row of bloated bodies, men, women and children. It brings back some grim memories.
I'm standing now right in front of a picture, pretty gruesome picture, I have to say, of a woman dressed in blue who's shielding her young child, I think about a year old, perhaps less. The reason I stopped here was because I remember that woman's body very, very well. It was one of the first that I came across. There's further on, there are pictures of heaps of bodies, which also I saw, and there are many of them inside houses as well as outside in the street. It reminds me very, very much of a house that I went into when I was wandering around. We were just free to go where we wanted. I saw a door open, I walked in, and a big room inside, a dining room with a dining table, and I suppose seven, eight people possibly sitting round. They'd been eating their evening meal. Above us was a shell that had penetrated the roof and was sticking into the room itself. And These people had all died absolutely instantaneously. One man had a smile. He'd obviously been telling a joke or listening to a joke or something and grinning as he heard it. Another old man was eating some bread and he had the bread still between his teeth, but he was slumped down in his chair, completely dead. They must have died within a second, possibly even less than that. It was the most extraordinary sight and an amazing example of the speed with which some of these gases worked. But at the same time, many of these bodies, as I look at some of the other pictures, I'm reminded of the awfulness of mustard gas, the crudest of all the gases that were used and the most evil in its effects.
This heavy basement door is typical of the kind of protection people relied on to shield them from Iraqi bombardment. Jibril was a young man at the time. He was away from home when the bombs fell, and he survived. His family, hiding in this basement, were not so lucky.
Around 4 o'clock, we decided to come home. When I started walking, all I saw was people falling to the ground, dead bodies, people throwing up. When I got to my parents' house, I went down to the basement. There were bodies lying on the stairs. Foam was coming out of their mouths. Then I saw that my family was all dead. I nearly went out of my mind.
As well as the nerve agents, sarin, tabun and VX, mustard gas is thought to have been the main killer in Halabja. Unlike the others, it's heavier than air and will sink to the lowest point. It's believed the main architect of the attack, Ali Hassan Majid, or Chemical Ali as he became known, may have deliberately arranged 2 days of conventional bombing beforehand, simply in order to smash windows, to make sure there was no obstruction to the poison seeping downwards. Remarkably, as I found out for myself, the gas even now continues to pose a threat.
I've just been down in this cellar where the people who were gassed died later. I mean, that was 25 years ago almost, but the fact is there are two recent bodies of rats down there. There's a skeleton of a cat that probably isn't actually all that old. And I've got a burning sensation in one of my eyes. And I think that maybe after all this time, the gas does still have a little slight lingering effect down there. It's certainly true that living things go down there and are killed.
I've come to the house of another survivor, Nasreen Abdel Kadir. Unsurprisingly, she doesn't enter her cellar anymore, and she won't go into her parents' family home either. The memories are too painful. Her detailed story is very distressing and amply demonstrates the horror of what mustard gas can do.
That morning, Iraqi choppers had been flying over Halabja. One of the crew members was by the door. He was taking pictures of us. I remember the children were waving at them, and the choppers kept on going around, taking pictures, the flash of the camera hitting us. Many people had gathered here at my family's house, neighbours and other relatives. My mother told us to go upstairs and get some food prepared. We were ready to serve when I heard a sound I'd never heard before, the sound of a bomb, a different kind of bomb, falling near our house. Suddenly, everything became dusty. Everything was covered with what looked like black ashes. There were birds, partridges, sitting on the tree in our garden. They were all dying, flapping their wings. I had no idea what was happening. I ran down to the cellar. Everyone's eyes were red, deep red, and they were throwing up. Then my husband came and shouted to us, "For God's sake, come outside. The place is attacked by chemical weapons." He was a doctor at the military hospital, and he knew about chemical warfare.
Amid the panic to escape the town, Nasreen's family split into different groups. She found herself with her brother, a group of small children, and the only neighbour they could find who had a vehicle.
It was getting late, toward evening, when we got to the edge of the town. I could see people lying on the roads. I thought they were sleeping. I couldn't believe that they were all dead. There were so many bodies everywhere. Then our driver started losing his mind. It must have been the effect of the gas. He was seeing things and couldn't drive anymore. We had no choice but to get off and walk. We had planned to meet my mum, my dad, my brothers and sisters in a town nearby. But we got lost and it was dark. Every adult had to carry two children, one on the back and the other held in our arms. The children kept throwing up and they were hallucinating. One kept saying he had to do his homework. Eventually, we found a bombed-out house and put the children down. They crawled into a corner. I could hear one of them shouting, "My eyes are blind." I thought that he was just exhausted. But another one shouted that he was blind also. Then everyone kept shouting that they were blind. And suddenly I found that I was going blind too. That's when I passed out.
When Nasreen and the others were finally rescued the next day, they still faced a long, arduous trek to get the proper medical treatment they needed. For many of them, including the children Nasreen was with, several of her brothers and sisters, and her mother, it was too late. In total, of the 27 people who took refuge in the family cellar, only 5 survived. As our BBC crew was preparing to leave, Nasreen brought out 2 sets of photographs. They were pictures of her 3 brothers and sisters and her mother, first before and then after their deaths.
Out of those in the cellar, I lost 4 of my closest family.
And these are, what's his name?
Faresir.
And hers?
Ashna.
Ashna. And this is Ashna.
Ashna.
Lying dead. So we have the 3 little children standing happily together. And then you've got the pictures of them as they lay dead. How many days after the gas attack did they die?
These pictures were taken in hospitals in Tehran around a week, no more than 10 days later.
I have to say, this is one of the most affecting things I think I've seen. I was here when these children died, but somehow... This is your mother?
Mother.
Also dead, lying dead. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
Today, Kurdistan is a very different place. For me, it's almost unrecognizable. For the last 20 years, it's enjoyed a large degree of independence from Baghdad, and there's been an oil boom that's brought considerable wealth to the region. Gone are the ruins and the horse-drawn vehicles. Instead, there are expensive cars and low-rise developments sprouting from all corners of Halabja's commercial center.
If you look at everywhere in the country, is rebuilding. Every place you go, is half of the building is gone up. It's a big project on the way. And in the past 2-3 years, it's been a lot of fast moving toward how to help the survivors.
Frishta Rapo is one of those hoping to help. She was a few miles from the town when the attack happened. She lost family and herself suffered mustard gas poisoning in later air raids. She's since been diagnosed with cancer, which she, like many others, blames on chemical weapons. She eventually escaped to Britain and has now returned to set up new schools in the region. She says that providing help, though, is about more than the offer of education and health care. Even after the trials and execution of Saddam Hussein and Chemical Ali, there's still a desperate need for justice.
Saddam is gone, Chemical Ali gone. There was other Kurdish people were involved with them. And above all of this, the most important thing, who provide those chemical weapons to Halabja? We always wish those body will be identified fully. If they were identified fully, we could get to the bottom of the nature of the gas and weapon, whatever is used. If those stuff was used, we find out and which country, those countries should go on trial as well. And this is need to be done by professionals.
Right, what I'm doing is just putting it in here to try and get a reading. I would say this is contaminated. Some of the other ones we've seen.
Thanks to some of the latest expertise in the field, help may be at hand.
If you spent any more than a few minutes, you could become very seriously ill.
This is Hamish de Breton Gordon. He used to be the British Army's leading chemical weapons expert. Now he works for a private company that's offering to clean up much of the town's toxic legacy.
As you can imagine, we have a problem around here when they're building new buildings. And they dig the foundations, they come across these pockets of mustard gas, which in contact with the air then evaporate, and people have died recently doing that. And that is one task that we're hoping that we'll help the Halabja mayor with and the KRG, so that should not happen in future.
But Hamish Gordon hopes to do more than simply decontaminate the town's cellars. The Kurdish regional government has recently invited bids to unearth the largest of the city's 33 mass graves, where some 5,000 victims are thought to lie. Using the latest forensic technology combined with DNA testing, Hamish Gordon says it's now possible to count and identify the victims precisely, and in doing so, unearth vital clues about what and who caused their deaths.
It's technically possible because, you know, nerve agent sucks the oxygen out of your blood, so you die in a certain way. Mustard gas basically blisters your lungs and your skin, and in effect you drown. So that will have a signature to it. Until we do it, we can't prove it, but we're fairly confident.
You'll be able to tell which gases, but could you be able to tell who made them, where they came from?
Well, we expect to find samples of mustard gas in the mass graves, as we have done in the cellars. And if we can break it down to its base molecule components, we will be able to see what its signature is. We know that there are still some chemical stockpiles in Iraq that have been dealt with, which is open source information, and we could certainly probably get a sample from there and match it against what we find here to provide conclusive evidence.
And that would really draw a line under it for a lot of people here, wouldn't it?
I think so. I mean, everybody I've spoken to, that closure is what they're looking for. And, you know, this is the time we must do it. With only 200 kilometres up the road, we see what's happening in Syria with the parallels there. This is the right time to actually get it done. And I think if we can do that for the people of Halabja, then they will be able to move forward and develop their lives without this horrific part of their history hanging unanswered over their heads.
For now, the Kurdish regional government has yet to approve the Halabja project. It says it wants to consult with other companies and with townspeople before it agrees to let so many mass graves be disturbed. But there is a clear political sense that as long as those foreign companies that knowingly supplied the weapons remain unpunished, this tragic chapter will never fully be closed. Germany, for instance, had exempted its companies in the 1980s from international treaties banning the trade in chemical weapons. Kubad Talabani is a senior minister in the regional government and the son of Iraq's current president.
Halabja and the genocide of Halabja is really a symbol of our tragedy. I think we owe it to ourselves, to the victims, to really take a more in-depth look at what happened, how it happened. And I think it's also we owe it to the families to do the best that we can to identify the missing, to identify the dead, to make sure that the new Iraq can never commit crimes like that again.
If it's discovered that, for instance, Russian companies, German companies were responsible for supplying the chemicals that were used against the Kurdish population, might there be some kind of action against those companies?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's something that we're very serious about. The victims, the families of the victims are serious about. And
so you'd push for that in international courts, would you?
It's probably too soon to say what vehicle we would use. I would leave that to the lawyers to determine the best course of action. But
you won't just sit back and say, oh, well, not, history was history.
No, we can't do that.
A high school history class in Halabja, the story of what their parents suffered, still has the power to generate tears among those born years after the attack. History remains very much alive here. No one can ever forget it. Witnessing these agonies, it's hard to think that any good could come out of such a brutal attempt to destroy a population. And yet, in a way, it did. The attack alerted the entire world to the sufferings of the Iraqi Kurds, and that led, less than 3 years later, to the establishment of a no-fly zone over northern Iraq, so Saddam Hussein couldn't do the same thing again. Kurdistan was effectively protected from Baghdad's military control, and it started to thrive as international money and local oil production restarted. The Iraqi Kurds are nowadays pretty much their own masters, something that hasn't happened for centuries. But all of this was achieved through terrible suffering, and many Kurds now feel that for this chapter to be closed, full and proper justice has to be done.
Look into my eyes, closely, and you can see I'm still injured. My eyes are damaged. I need an operation. And my lungs are damaged too.
This final thought from Nasreen Abdelkadir, the young wife who lost her husband, her mother, and three of her siblings in the attack.
It is true that every human being wants to live. But it should be a life without pain. For us, in Halabja, every day is like the day of the attack. The pain never goes away. It remains in our hearts, deep down.
You've been listening to The Halabja Project with me, John Simpson. The producer was Ed Butler.